Chapter 6 Nikki. Tender reminiscences of travels with Van Halen, AC/DC, Iron Maiden, and other gentle wayfarers of outlandish repute. When we left the Aussie tour to do some shows on our own, bringing along Rat for extra entertainment, the world, our world, wasn't the same anymore. I heard Shout at the Devil, Too Young to Fall in Love, and Looks That Kill everywhere. There was hysteria whenever we showed up at record stores to sign albums. And when we performed in towns we'd never even been to before, thousands of kids would show up. We were in a new world, one I'd always wanted to be in since I saw that first rock concert in a gymnasium in Jerome. But I was just an Idaho kid. I didn't know what to do in this new world or how to act. So I improvised. After a concert at the Bronco Bowl in Dallas, Texas, a blonde and a brunette in spandex and tube tops stumbled backstage before the show and said they wanted to do the whole band. It was either Vince or I who came up with the great idea of telling them they'd have to work for it. We grabbed a champagne bottle off the hospitality table and told the brunette that if she wanted to fuck us, she'd have to take the bottle and sit on it in the middle of the room. If you're not still sitting on that bottle when we come back, then you can't fuck the band, Vince said as we went on stage to play. After the show, she was still there, squatting in the middle of the room. Vince ducked into the production office to get a blowjob from two other girls simultaneously. Then we brought the two spandex girls out to the van. Vince and Tommy took the front seat and Mick and I sat in the back. The girls climbed into the front seat with Vince and Tommy and peeled off their clothes, which took a good 5 minutes because they were so tight. By the time they were off, Vince and Tommy were already fucking them doggy style. The girls were bent over the top of the seat, so the blonde grabbed at my pants as she was being fucked while the brunette did the same to Mick. They fumbled, unsnapped, and unzipped until they were blowing both of us. When we pulled into the hotel, we told the girls they had to remain naked. We took the elevator to Vince and Tommy's room and started drinking and getting stupid. The blonde was sitting with her legs spread open on the bed, and that gave us ideas. Tommy came back from the bathroom with a tube of toothpaste, so we stuffed it up her cap first. Then we figured it just wasn't fair to leave her with toothpaste, but no toothbrush. "What else do we have?" Tommy asked. "How about the fucking phone?" someone, probably me, suggested. We took the receiver off the hook and worked it inside until just the mouthpiece was hanging out. The girl sat there laughing the whole time, moaning occasionally, either because she was aroused or because she wanted us to think she was. "I'm hungry," Mick, who was watching bored from an armchair, grumbled. We told him to fuck off, then realized that maybe a compromise was possible. I dialed room service, and suddenly, through the blonde's open legs, we heard a muffled voice. "Hello, room service." I bent over and recited our order into the girl's crotch. "What room?" "Room 227, I answered. The brunette started laughing. Suddenly, Vince, in a flash of inspiration, turned to her. "What do you think you're laughing at?" She stopped and stared at him blankly. "Does your mother know where you are?" Vince asked. "No," the girl said. "Don't you think she's worried about you?" "Maybe, I don't know. Perhaps you should call her." Suddenly it dawned on us what deviltry Vince was hatching. "What's her phone number?" She gave it to Vince, and he dialed it. Her mother answered, and the brunette bent over her friend's crotch. "Hi, Mom. I just called to say I'd be home soon. I'm at Sherry's right now, okay? Thanks." We didn't just lose respect for the girls that night. We lost respect for ourselves. When I returned to L.A., my half-sister Cece called and said that my mother had cracked and been committed to a mental institution in Seattle. I hadn't talked to my mother since I left her standing at the Greyhound terminal 6 years ago, and though I was still so angry and bitter, I felt like I needed to see her again, to connect with some element of my past before I lost it all. So I took a plane to Seattle, saddened by the fact that we were having our reunion in a mental hospital. When I walked in, I hardly recognized her. Those 6 years had not been good to her. Once, she'd had it all, looks, talent, and wit. But now she looked more like Ozzy than my mother. I ran up to her and stopped short of hugging her. She fixed me with her eyes, and the first thing out of her mouth was, "Did you write that song about me?" "What song?" I asked, confused. "Looks That Kill." I was floored. There were so many things I wanted to say to her, so many things I wanted her to say to me. But that wasn't one of them. I checked her out, put her in a cab, and brought her to my sister's house. We hardly spoke the whole time. We were both too proud and stubborn to explain or apologize for anything. As we sat in my sister's living room, flashing each other dirty, malevolent looks while my sister stood nearby, disapproving of both of us, I remembered why I had left in the first place. I just didn't belong there. And so I stood up, left, and caught the next plane to Los Angeles, back to the relative sanity of my drug dealers. The following week, we left for England to play a handful of dates on the Monsters of Rock bill with Van Halen, AC/DC, Dio, and for one date, Y&T. The night we arrived in England, I was lying on my bed in a Novotel outside Nottingham when I heard a knocking sound on the bathroom window. I tried to tune it out, assuming that it was just my imagination, but it was persistent. Finally, I got up to look and discovered a leggy, beautiful blonde standing on the ledge outside. I opened the window, and she looked me up and down. "Mind if I come in?" she asked, casual and polite, as if she were the neighborhood vicar stopping by for afternoon tea. She very daintily stepped into the bathroom and asked, "Mind if I drop my knickers?" "No, go ahead," I answered, taken aback. Though I was trying to seem casual, I'd never been more excited. "This is fucking cool," I thought to myself. "I'm in England, the home of all my favorite bands, the Sweet, Slade, Bowie, Queen, the Sex Pistols, and there's a chick coming in through the bathroom window, just like in the Beatles song." She took off her pants so that they were hanging loose around one leg. I sat down on the toilet and she straddled me. With one hand on the towel rack and the other grabbing my hair, she got off. She stood up, pulled up her pants, and bowed slightly. "Thank you very much," she said in her genteel accent. "It's been an honor." Then she climbed onto the windowsill, stepped out to the ledge, and was gone. I picked up the phone and called Mick, Tommy, and Vince to tell them what had just happened and how much I loved England. The next day was the kickoff of the Monsters of Rock mini tour. While we were traveling in the States with Rat, we had gotten into the habit of biting each other. Tommy would grab Vince, or a security guard, and clamp his teeth down on an arm until he broke the skin. It was all affectionate, of course, but it hurt like hell if you weren't fucked up. I was so drunk and coked up that first show that I walked up to Eddie Van Halen and tackled him. Then I reared my head up, lifted his shirt, and sank my teeth into his bare stomach. "What the fuck is wrong with you?" his wife, Valerie Bertinelli, bellowed. "Biting my husband? You fucking freak!" Eddie stood up, dusted himself off, and narrowed his squinty eyes. I couldn't tell whether he was turned on or offended. Before I had a chance to apologize, Vince ran up to him like a savage dog and sank his teeth into his hand. And that threw Valerie into hysterics. Nobody bites the hand that Eddie Van Halen uses to play guitar with. I must have bitten Angus Young, too, because his brother Malcolm walked up to me in a rage. I was wearing platform boots, and Malcolm's face was eye level with my belly button. "You fucking bastard," he roared at my navel. "You can bite my brother, fine, but if you fucking bite me, I'll bite your fucking nose off, you dog-faced faggot." I think I said something like, "You and what stepladder?" Because before I knew it, he was attacking me, climbing up my leg and clawing at my face like a crazed cat. Doc McGee pulled him off and, holding him by the scruff of the neck, threw him outside the dressing room. We could hear him scratching at the door and hissing as Doug told us the news. "Congratulations," he said. "After this tour, you're opening for Iron Maiden." "Fucking cool. Now I don't have to go home," I said, thinking about my midnight visitor the night before. "By the way," Doc continued, "Bruce Dickinson would like to meet you." Bruce was Iron Maiden's new singer, and though his literary galloping heavy metal was never my favorite music, he was still a legend. Doc walked out the door and, holding Malcolm at bay with his right hand, signaled to Bruce and a woman who was with him. They walked into the dressing room. My heart dropped into my hands and my testicles shrank to the size of Malcolm's little fists. I tried to stammer hello to them, but found myself tongue-tied. There she was, the girl who had crawled in my window the night before. And I didn't know if she was Bruce Dickinson's wife, girlfriend, manager, personal assistant, or what. It was on the Monsters of Rock and Iron Maiden tours that the tedium began. In Hollywood, gigging was a way of life. But gigging was not the same as touring. When you gig, you get to go home afterward. Touring is an endless parade of anonymity, faceless people, identical hotel rooms, and indistinguishable cities, always changing but always the same. In America, at least we had the consolation of watching our star rise as we toured. But in Europe, nothing seemed real or relevant. On past tours, I would sit in my hotel room and write postcards to my grandparents in Jerome, Idaho, population 4,000, telling them how lonely I was and how much I missed having a home to go to. But after my reunion with my mother, I didn't want a home anymore. I became crazier and more reckless, subconsciously putting myself on the same self-destructive path my mother had been on. My rock and roll fantasy wasn't just about success and decadence and rebellion anymore. It was also about pain and death. I was sure I was going to die before I was 25. I think we all thought that. Tommy and I began breaking glass bottles over each other's head and twisting the light bulbs out of makeup mirrors and swallowing them whole, just for fun. When Vince was in a bathroom with some groupie or waitress, we'd sneak in, not because we wanted to double-team her, but because we wanted to sneak the drugs out of Vince's pants pocket while he was preoccupied. As singer, Vince had the hardest time recuperating from all the partying. He was usually so thrashed that the only way he could make it through most shows was if we called a doctor to shoot his ass full of cortisone before going on stage. At the Ritz in Paris, Vince was trying to get to the front desk for a phone call, but he was so fucked up he couldn't figure out how to open the glass door at the hotel entrance. So he kicked through it, shattering the glass and sending the brass door handle clattering to the ground. He picked the brass handle off the floor, handed it to the concierge, and took the call as if nothing had happened. In Germany, we got high with Claude Schnell, the keyboard player from Dio, in his hotel room. When he ran out of the room to get something, we decided to fuck with him. We picked up the two tiny European beds in the room and threw them, piece by piece, out the window, followed by his chairs, desk, television, and dresser. Two brand-new Mercedes-Benzes were parked below the room, and each piece of furniture managed to land on one. Suddenly, the German police were knocking on Claude's door with Rottweilers. His whole band had to pack up and leave the hotel, which banned Dio for years, while we stayed there guiltily. I may not like their Intermission album, but I'll always give Dio credit for not telling on us. In Switzerland, after the Iron Maiden tour, we weren't so lucky. Tommy and Vince bought flare guns and fired one in their room. A giant ball of fire shot out and ricocheted off the walls before setting Tommy's mattress on fire. He and Vince were so amused that they ran to find Doc to show him the flaming bed. But when they returned to the room with him, they discovered that they had locked their keys inside. By the time the maid let them in, smoke was billowing from under the door. For some reason, they didn't kick us out of the hotel until the following day when we used the giant balls of metal attached to the room keys to break all the glass windows in the elevators. We were really fucking bored of Europe. Adding an extra element of awkward tension to the Maiden tour was the fact that the mystery bathroom window girl hung around Bruce the whole time. Every time I saw Bruce, he would offer me fencing lessons because he was really into sword play. I kept turning him down, though, because I was sure he was going to use the fencing lesson as an excuse to accidentally stab me to death for fucking her. When Maiden's drummer, Nico McBain, was busted on the border between France and Germany for carrying hash, no one in the band bothered to warn us back at the venue, where we were always the last to leave because we were partying. I always thought that this was a purposeful act of revenge, because when we finally reached the border, customs officials and dogs swarmed onto the bus as we snorted and swallowed everything we could find. When they went through Tommy's bags, a giant lump of hash fell onto the ground. It sat there for minutes, looking like a dirt clod, as we sweated nervously. Then, the official searching Tommy's bag zipped it up, looked around the bus, and walked toward Vince. He stepped on the hash, and it stuck to the bottom of his shoe like a piece of gum. The officers then made me strip, put my arms against the wall, and bend over so that they could look up my ass. I tightened my sphincter muscle and tried as hard as I could to shit on their heads. I pushed and pushed and pushed, but couldn't get any results. After the border incident, we started planting bugs in Iron Maiden's dressing room to find out, first, if they were responsible for the intense search, and second, who the fuck that girl was. Except for Nico, none of them seemed to like us. On the last night of the tour, Bruce even walked up to Mick and challenged him to a duel. I think he thought that Mick had messed around with that girl. By the end of the European tour, we sounded terrible. Vince was getting so fucked up every night that no doctor or medication could make him sound good on stage. Our last show in Europe, at the Dominion Theater in London, was our worst. We looked ridiculous because our style was beginning to evolve from Road Warrior darkness to more colorful, theatrical one-piece court jester suits. For the show, I wore a dark green outfit, painted my bass the same color, and put on matching moccasin shoes. I looked like an overgrown leprechaun. There must have been a butcher shop or something nearby because throughout the show, fans kept catapulting leg bones and animal heads and strange sausages at us. We took it as a compliment until Tommy's drum tech, Clyde Duncan, collapsed to the ground. We looked over, and he had a dart sticking out of his back. Tommy, with one hand, pulled the dart out while playing. Minutes after that, the dry ice machine blew up. A strong odor of what smelled like hot dog juice wafted across the stage and clung to my clothing, and a wet puddle formed around my feet. The road crew, I assumed, was pouring hot dog juice onto the stage as an end-of-tour joke. I thought it was a pretty lame prank, but when I looked back at Tommy, he seemed panic-stricken. His drum set was surrounded by water, and I assumed they had poured hot dog juice all over him, too. After Vince croaked through our last song, I splashed through the water on the stage to find Tommy. He was leaning over Clyde, and the smell of hot dogs was unbearable. I moved in closer and discovered that the smell was actually Clyde's burned skin. The dry ice machine had blown up in his face, frying his skin like a kosher red hot and sending water running down the stage, which sloped forward. Clyde was still in agony when we flew back to America afterward. Fortunately, we had a lot of painkillers. At the time, we didn't think of drugs as addictive. They were just something that we liked to do all the time to keep ourselves from getting bored. We weren't addicted. We were just constant users. As we flew home, I thought about another plane ride. A few months before, after we had received our platinum awards in Manhattan for Shout at the Devil, I flew to Nantucket to meet some girls. I had met Demi Moore at the award parties, and she was waiting to greet me as the prop plane arrived. She was working on a movie there with Bobcat Goldthwait, who was also on the runway along with a handful of other actors and crew members. My head was spinning because I had gotten so drunk and high on the flight. I walked out of the plane to the top of the staircase leading to the tarmac. I had the awards cradled in my left hand, a bottle of Jack in my right hand, and an ounce of cocaine crushed flat in my back pocket. I imagine them looking at me. I looked like a real rock star, like Johnny Thunders. As I stepped down from the doorway, my shoe slid off the edge of the top step and I lost my balance. I tried to catch myself on the railing, but only succeeded in dropping the bottle of Jack, which smashed on the steps below. I followed it, tumbling headfirst, a mess of broken glass, alcohol, and limbs. I hit the runway first, followed by the award plaques, which knocked me in the head. I opened my eyes to find Demi, Bobcat, and their friends standing over me, helping me to my feet and looking at me very disapprovingly. They had been where I was. That day was the first time I heard of AA. When Demi and Bobcat suggested that I look into the program, I shrugged them off. But I could see it in their eyes and the way they shook their heads and looked at each other. They knew that very soon I would be one of them. I was partying without any thought for consequences because to me, consequences didn't exist. We were Motley Crue. We had a platinum record, and we were bigger than the New York Dolls ever were. We were young, fucked up, and worshipped for it. Words like consequences, responsibility, morality, and self-control didn't apply to us. Or so we thought.